Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Cameron Krager, 26 years of career experience, second-generation firefighter, Deputy Chief of Special Operations for Dallas Fire Department. At the age of 10, Cameron was doing ride-alongs with his father, who retired as a captain with 42 years of service. Cameron knew his calling from the jump and where he wanted to be. He also felt the pressures of having to live up to your last name when your father created a standard. My discussions with Cameron was real, truthful, sincere, and honest. The takeaways that can be gained from listening to his experiences should no doubt help any of the listeners who might be going through the same issues. This was a fantastic interview, and I truly hope you all enjoy. With that, I present Cameron Krager.
My name is Cameron Krager. I'm a Deputy Chief Special Operations for Dallas Fire Department. I've been here for 26 years. My journey to get here was just a lifelong. It's all I ever wanted to do. My father was a Dallas firefighter, retired captain, 42 years. So I started coming to the fire station when I was 10 years old. Spending the night at the fire station on the weekends. He let me ride out. Got to see some fires, and so it was that. You know, that's never wanted to do anything else. Never even applied for another department. I went to college, a small college, and played football. But the lasting impact, like the last big, like, this is absolutely what I'm going to do. So we grew up in a small town, and 700 people in my town. And I could tell you exactly what I had on that night at the kitchen table. A high school kid, the telephone rings, my dad answers. He gets off. He says, "Hey, they said the caller said there's a house on fire in town. Let's go." And I had a 64 Chevy pickup, 350, 400 turbo transmission, 16 inch glass packs, loud, powerful. And he said, "You drive." And we hauled ass out of the driveway. We get to a stop sign. You can see the column of smoke. It was about 3 miles from our house. And I'm coming to an intersection. And he was just like, "Go, go, go." And I romped down on it, not coming to a stop. And we pulled up in front of the house. The front of the house is going. About that time, the volunteer fire engine is rolling up. And my dad just grabbed the cross lay and jumped up on the front, knocked down the front porch, through the front door. I didn't see him. The fire goes out. He comes out. He doesn't have any hair left on his arms, no eyelashes. And he was like, "Do you want to come in here and mop this up?" And so he gave me the nozzle. I'm just hitting hot spots. I'm like, "Yep, that's it." So went to college, graduated from college, and got on the fire department of April 26, 1999, 4 months after I graduated college. Got on the Dallas Fire Department.
Okay. When you got on, was your dad still a member?
He was. My dad was here for 42 years. We had what was called the drop plan. We still have it. It's nothing like it was back then. Pension crisis hit in 2017. So these guys worked a long time. They stayed in the drop. And so he was here for 42 years. And I can tell you, after being here 26 years, about the first 17, 18 years of my career, even when I was making rank, even when I was the same rank as him, there wasn't a fire station that I walked into that it wasn't, "Hey, you're Curtis's boy." And so I always had to try to live up to that level, because they never even called me by my rank. It was just, "You're Curtis's boy." So yeah, I got to have some fires with my dad. We worked in the same area of town. There's a story there where he educated me on some things. So I got to have some fires with him before he retired.
Okay. Now, I'm not a generational firefighter, but I can only imagine when you have a father or a mother or whatever the case may be that has that reputation, you coming into the job, that's a shit ton of pressure that's on you.
Oh, without a doubt. And because, like, he worked He was an engine captain. He never rode a truck. He talked shit about truck captains, people that rode trucks. He was an engine guy that put the fires out, and he was a large personality in a hot area of the city that had made a lot of fires. And he, you either loved him or you hate him, but there was plenty of both in within the department. So, you walk into a fire station, you either had either being Curtis's boy was a good thing or it was a bad thing, but there was no in between. And so, yeah, hey, you act like you got your daddy's time on. If you know how many times, you hear that throughout the early stages of your career, or you're able to answer questions and people like, oh, you think you know everything about the fire department. No, I love the fire department and I'm passionate about it. And I do know these answers because I've been coming up here since I was 10, but I get it. Yeah, but there was a lot of pressure with the negative comments of you got your daddy's time on to living up to, hey man, you it's kind of like he would tell me he didn't like to drive when he was a driver because you can pump to 100 fires as long as you get water every time. Nobody gives a shit. It's that one time as a pump, as a driver engineer, you couldn't get water, then you're the asshole that can't get water, right? And so if you stumped your toe at a fire and you weren't very, you're not good, or you backed out of one or whatever, you're like, oh man, am I going to get ridiculed? So it was like, hey, I got to be aggressive. I got to live up to a standard here that like he's proud of, or they're like, man, Curtis's boy is, he's not very, all you ever want to do as a fireman is hear he's a damn good fireman. Like if somebody says he's a nice guy, well then that's like the ultimate slap in the face, right? Like, that says you don't have anything nice to say about him, so you say he's a nice guy. Or that's how it is here in Dallas. If somebody brings up a name, you go, he's a damn good fireman. Like, that's the ultimate compliment. And that's all you wanted to hear coming up through the fire department, people saying about you.
Okay. With that being said, when you joined, did you have to go through some sort of recruit academy or recruit class?
Yeah, so when you get hired in Dallas, you go straight through Dallas, the Fire Academy, and you get certified firefighter, then you go through EMT school, then they send you to A&P school, then they send you to paramedic school. So you don't see a fire station other than a few EMS rides for 18 months. So your first 18 months is solid school from fire academy, EMT, and paramedic school. And then you get assigned to a fire station once you get out of 18 months of training.
Okay. So with that being said, what was your first assignment?
So I talked about the cities divided in half, and we had the Trinity River that splits it. And so North Dallas and south and north of the river and south of the river, two very different mindsets and cultures. And hey, you only put out shotgun houses and y'all are not aggressive. So my dad worked south of the river at a busy fire station, Station 33. I got assigned to 37s, which was in North Dallas. And I thought, wow, what a disservice. Like, what am I like? He had never worked north of the river. And I got assigned north of the river and thought, oh man, this is, why did I have to come up here? So my first assignment was Station 37. And at that time, you're on probation. You have to do 6 months of probation before you can write a letter to transfer. So I did my 6 months at 37, 6 months and one day. I wrote a letter to leave 37 Fire Station, and I went to what is an area of the city called the Grove, which is south of the river, and so caught an immediate transfer to an area I could get down south in.
Okay.
So,
And so once you got that assignment you requested, did you seek out or did you know because of your father, did you know people there that you wanted to kind of straight go to for training? Hey, how do you guys do things like that?
yeah, so not really. One of my classmates was there, and it was more my dad had never worked in the Grove. So I don't know where you're like, there's 59 fire stations in the city of Dallas, and so every pocket has a different name. So Pleasant Grove is an area, South Dallas is its own area, Oak Cliff, West Oak Cliff, West Dallas, these are all pockets, and you're kind of like, this is, my dad was an Oak Cliff guy. Pretty much his whole career, other than a short stint, an Oak Cliff guy. He had never worked in the Grove, but it was those positions in Oak Cliff were hard to get. I needed the fastest way to get out of 37s and 34s. Had an opening. It was south of the river. It had a good reputation, and I had a buddy from rookie school that said, "Hey, man, come down here." So I went down there.
Okay.
But I will say, I was there for about 2.5 years, and a neighboring station to my father at 33s was 25s, and they were putting an ambulance in full time that they had not had. So paramedics were going to have to go to that fire station, and so I got to go to Oak Cliff as my third assignment. I went to 25 fire station in Oak Cliff, and 34s was great. I had a great time. I had a great teacher, and we remained friends for a long time. Captain Sutton, he took me in my first fire. That was very interesting. Fire was in the back of the house, middle to the back of the house. I had the nozzle. He said, "Hey, go to where you hear it." And I had never heard that term before. Go to where you hear it. And so go through the threshold, through the front door. And I never heard one. It's like the clearest I ever heard a fire, the crackling and the popping. And with your ears and not having any visibility and finding that fire by hearing it, by hearing the crackling and the popping, and to get put on that fire and get it knocked down. So I had a great mentor and two good officers and a good ambulance crew. So in Dallas, when you come out, so basically one shift's on a fire engine or fire truck, and the other shift you're on the ambulance. And that's your rotation for the first part of your career. So
Okay. I was a question I was going to ask you is it every shift that rotates or is it by pay cycle or?
it's basically it's 50. It's about a 50-50 rule that we have. And so there's five, so there's four paramedics and then one paramedic driver assigned to the ambulance. But even though if you're assigned to the ambulance, you're still rotating on and off a heavy apparatus to an ambulance. And it works out to, four or five, six shifts a month rotating on the ambulance and then onto a heavy. In those years, it was like you walked in because the ambulance was such a beating, and it still is a beating. Your ambulance day, you just kind of like slow motion robot because you just got to get in that groove. You're fixing to get beat up 20 runs a shift, run after run. You're going to be up all night. So it's kind of like you set a pace, and you can see the guy or girl on the ambulance, their mentality. And then you walk in on your engine day and it's like you're bebopping, you feel good, you're putting your stuff on the engine. You're like, I get to be a firefighter today. And so it really is, or it was then, two different mindsets. Like your engine day and your ambulance day, was two different mindsets.
Okay. And I'm assuming if you're on the ambulance, no fire duty, right? Because some organizations allow their ambulances to run structural boxes and things like that.
Yeah, pretty much no. I mean, you may get assigned to it. There was part. Early in the career, you weren't assigned to the structure fire, and then if it became a working structure fire, they would assign one rescue to it. And your job was, if somebody got hurt or if there was a citizen that needed to be looked at, then you did that. Now some guys would, maybe get to pull a little line out in the yard or maybe go run and set a ladder, but no, you don't bunk out and get to go into the fire
Okay.
on your ambulance day.
And what's, I don't want to sound like harsh on this next question, but what's the way to get off the ambulance entirely? Is it through promotion?
So that's a huge, in our department, it was a huge motivation. So those guys, if you don't promote, you're looking at riding the ambulance. Back then, you were looking at riding it 12 to 15 years of going back and forth. If you promoted, once you make the rank, so in our rank, you're a firefighter. The next rank is a driver. So even when I made driver, you're assigned to the ambulance. Rotate. You're assigned to the ambulance driver spot. Now, that doesn't mean you ride it every shift. Then your engine or truck day, if you're at a double company house with your ambulance, or a single company with just an engine and ambulance, if that heavy apparatus driver's at work, you ride the back of the fire engine or the back of the fire truck. If the driver was off and you weren't scheduled to ride the ambulance, then you drove. So I can honestly say when I made driver, I was at a just a single company house. So it was an ambulance and a fire engine. The driver rarely took off, and so I rode the back of an engine. I to be fair, even in the city of Dallas, I bet I only pumped to one fire maybe in as a driver, because I didn't stay a driver long. It's not a rank that I was interested in staying at. Didn't really like driving because I like to go in. So, but I was assigned to an ambulance, and so rarely did I drive.
Okay. And how would one get to that permanent driver's position? Is that based on seniority?
Based on seniority, and the city will, the department will flip flop here in Dallas. Like we had for a long time, we had dedicated heavy apparatus drivers, and then a shift was made where, hey, we went to instead of five medics assigned to the rescue, or a rotation, we call it a rotation. Five in a rotation, we made it six to a rotation. In order to get six to the rotation, we took drivers off the heavy, and so paramedic drivers would switch. So paramedic driver would be driving the engine one day, and one paramedic driver would be driving the ambulance, and then they would flip flop. And now we've come back full circle again. We finally got back to where we have dedicated heavy apparatus drivers, which will cause a backlog of if you make driver now, because we're coming up, we're going to have a promotional exam, and FROs are getting off the ambulance. And because we had in 2017, when the pension crisis happened, all the old heads left. So we became a really young department overnight in 2017. So now these firefighters are getting off the ambulance in around 8 years. But drivers, now that we went back to dedicated heavy drivers, you can't, as an ambulance driver, to get on a heavy apparatus as a driver, somebody's going to have to retire. And those are fewer positions. So FROs are now looking, going, do I want to promote and have to stay on this ambulance longer? But I got to do that to be a lieutenant. Or do I just stay an FRO, wait till I get off the ambulance, and then promote to a driver? So we go back and forth within the department over the 26 years on how to get off the ambulance. But the surefire way is to make lieutenant. No lieutenant in the fire department rides a frontline ambulance. That's your ticket off of the ambulance, and just riding a fire apparatus is to make officer.
Okay. And are you allowed to skip rank, or do you have to go through each rank? Or I'm sorry, each position?
You have to go through each rank. So you're a firefighter, you test for driver, you make driver, you can test for lieutenant. Once you make lieutenant, you can test for captain. Test for captain, make captain, then you make battalion chief. And that's where the civil service ranks stop in our department. So my rank, deputy rank, it's called an executive officer, and those are appointments by the fire chief. So you don't take a test to become my rank. The last testable rank is battalion chief, and that's the last, what they call civil service protection, is as the battalion rank. So you're basically an at-will employee of the fire chief once you promote to deputy.
Okay. With that, if the fire chief who like promoted you into that position leaves and you get a new one, are you at the mercy of the new fire chief? Or how does that work?
I can honestly say we have never had a fire chief came in that said, I don't want you as an executive. I believe there's a possibility there. You would get to return to your civil service rank. So I wouldn't get fired per se. I could retreat back to battalion chief, but it's never happened. I was promoted under a chief. So Chief Coatney promoted me to deputy, and then he left shortly thereafter. And we've had Chief Artis became the fire chief. He was internal. He got promoted up to basically to a new position. It wasn't like an assistant city manager position, but they made it the chief of public safety. So he's now over police and fire. And so now we have a new chief, Chief Ball, who he's a career Dallas guy as well. And so I'm on my third fire chief as a deputy chief. And I would honestly say, if I was a fire chief, I think you should get to pick your executive staff. Like, if he did not want me or did not see that I believed in his vision or supported him, or he felt somebody would be better suited, I think they should have the ability to say, hey, you can either retire or you can go back to your civil service rank. We don't do it. We've never done it. But I do see that if I was the chief, I would be like, if you're not buying into my strategic plans or my vision for this department, then you can go or you can bust back. But we don't do it. It's never been done in Dallas Fire Department. So
Okay. And is your current chief now, you mentioned public safety. Is the current chief now in charge of both fire and police or no?
no, so the, there's now, so they did away with the assistant city manager position over. So we had an assistant city manager that was over police and fire. They basically took that person out, made my fire chief the chief of public safety, and he is over police and fire, and then we still have our fire chief. So
Okay.
I had like it's we got a new city manager, and that's what she created, a chief of public safety, and she appointed our fire chief the chief of public safety. So he's over police and fire, and then that created, okay, well now we need a fire chief, and we just went internal, and Chief Ball became the fire chief.
So quick question, because I'm very curious. Who's higher in authority or rank between the two?
So the fire chief answers to the chief of public safety, who answers to the city manager.
Understood.
So it's like we will talk about leadership and things in a little bit, but everybody's got a boss, right? Like the idea that, and it's what's funny, people will say, what's Chief Krager want to do in special ops? Well, there's things I want to do, but I have a boss too. Who has a boss? You know, it's not so simple as to say we're going to do. I'm the deputy chief of special operations, and we're going to change X, Y, and Z. I wish it was that simple, but it's not. Like I have my boss is over me, who's over multiple bureaus or divisions, and so I'm the deputy chief of special operations. My boss is the assistant chief, and that assistant chief is over operations, EMS, and special ops. And he answers directly to the fire chief, who answers to the chief of public safety, who answers to the city manager, who answers to the city council. So everybody has bosses.
Gotcha. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. So my next question for you is, at what point did you decide to start moving up the ranks and why?
Well, that was really easy. I've had multiple mentors, but I've had two people that I've looked up to in my 26 years to the highest level. And the first one obviously was my father. And my father being an engine captain in a busy station that had lots of fires, from the moment I got on, I wanted to be an engine captain. And so and he gave me advice, and then he came back, and it's a funny story later, but he said two things I want you to know. Never pass up a promotion, and never get happy at a fire station where you're at. And the reason you don't want to be happy is he said, like himself, hey, I loved working here with this group of guys, and we were having the best time, and life was good. And I thought, man, I'm working my whole career here. And a promotional exam came up, and I'm like, no, we're good, man. This is a fun place to work. And everybody promoted. And then it's like, where did everybody go? I didn't promote. I thought this was it. And he says, so never get happy where you're at, and never pass up an opportunity to promote, because it's more money for the rest of your life. You know, a lot of people do side jobs and they're too busy to study for promotions. You look at what a private makes in our fire department when they get ready to retire with their pension, and you look at what a deputy chief makes, and you go, because it's not just more money, this paycheck. When you retire from here, our pension, the way it's set up, it's that pension is set for the rest of your life. And so, not that I was motivated by money, but he instilled that into me. So from the moment I got on, I never passed up a promotion, and worked my way up through the ranks. Now I will say he never took a battalion chief's test, and when I made captain, I got to go. My station housed the battalion chief, and that battalion chief. He should have, everybody in the fire service should know Mike Jones, Chief Mike Jones. He's a battalion chief in the city of Dallas. He retired a few years ago. He got on in 1961. He retired about a little over a year or so ago at the age of 82, 82, 83 years of age. The most dedicated, most passionate, most aggressive, even in his 80s, put his firefighting coat on, put his SCBA on. He's up in the fire with you, super vocal, aggressive, like an 80-year-old. Yes, sir, an 80-year-old. And so he wasn't 80 when I worked for him back in 2010, but he made being a battalion chief look so fun. He had a deal. When I first went to work for him, that's a different area of town. This is East Dallas. And he's this famous fire chief because he'd been on since not. He left a short time to go do a stint in Vietnam, but he came back. But he got on in 61, did a stint in Vietnam. So that everybody knew this famous fire chief, Mike Jones. And I went to work for him. I made captain and got to go to the 8 fire station in East Dallas. And 8 fire station houses Battalion 3. He was Battalion 3. And our first meeting, he said, hey, Cap. I want you to be aggressive. He said, don't make me come in there and whisper sweet nothings in your ear and kick your ass into a fire. I said, yes, sir. And so when we talk about motivation and we talk about wanting to be good at your job, like when I say motivated by fear, I'm not talking about I wasn't scared of the man. I was scared I was going to let the man down. Like there would have been no greater disappointment in myself than for Mike Jones to look at me and go that I wasn't very good at my job. So motivation to say, all I want Mike Jones is to say he's a damn good captain. And so and I knew that Mike Jones, we had a relationship because later in my career I become his boss, which was interesting. But when you're in a fire, and I used it the whole time I was in operations. If I call you by your first name, it just means more.
It means more,
So
yeah. Yeah.
this fire is bad, and we roll up. If I was to say, Lieutenant, I need, like, he would look at me and say, Cameron, come here. And Cameron, come here, Mitt. You're going to get the job done. Like, I got these crews, Cameron, come here. And that meant he's fixing to give me an assignment to get to work. And so that's when I'm like, okay, he trusts me, right? But nobody knows the story of Mike Jones, right? Like you think a guy that worked 60 something years in a fire department like Dallas and was a battalion chief all those years. But anyway, so when I went there and was working for him, he said, hey, anytime Engine 8 doesn't go on a multiple that I'm rolling on and you're comfortable with your crew to ride short, meaning he said, just throw your gear on and go with me. And so Battalion 3 is one of those where it's located. Just about any 2-alarm fire in the city, we get 4 chiefs. So initially on a 1-alarm fire, you get 2 chiefs. On a 2-alarm fire, you get 2 more. Battalion 3 is situated where just about everywhere in the city, Battalion 3 is going to go to a multiple alarm fire. And so a multiple would come in, I'd grab my coat, helmet, bunkers, throw it in the back of the chief's car. We would roll, and I was like, this is the lick, man. This is the to be a battalion chief going to all these fires made me want to promote because I was 32 years old. I'd made captain. I finally realized at 32, I was never going to be satisfied. Like, I was like, man, I made it. This is the goal, be an engine captain. I'm an engine captain on Engine 8. I'm 32 years old. And you go, is this what I'm going to do for the next 20 years? Like, is this it? Like, and then I'm working for Chief Jones, and I'm like, no, that's it. That battalion chief's job is it. And so I studied, and I made battalion chief. And my dad was like, he was just disgusted. He was like, you do realize you're just a glorified mail carrier. Like your firefighting days are over. I'm like, you told me never to pass up a promotion. He's like, to be a captain, like that's because he never took a battalion chief's. He never even took the exam. He never even tried. And so it was like, he was almost like he was put out with me. Like, man, your firefighting days are over. You just deliver the mail. Like, what you stand out in the yard and ask captains, hey, what do we think we should do here? But so anyway, I caught a little flack for being a battalion chief with my father.
That's pretty, that's astounding. So Could that happen today? Like, is there an age requirement or an age cutoff for Dallas, or no?
We do not have an age requirement in Dallas. You can, nope, we do not. Now, I will say he probably stayed that, and he was losing money, right? Like in the drop plan, it got frozen, and there's a whole piece there. But those guys stayed, a lot of them stayed way too long because they were making so much money. We had the most lucrative pension system probably in the country at that time before the pension crisis, and the state legislature had to get involved in 2017. So, right, like for me, it probably won't ever happen again because when I reach the age of 56, I'm going to have reached my maximum pension of 90. We get 90% of what our base salary is. After that, if you want to keep working, you'd make more not coming to work and retiring than you would make. You could get into the still could get into our current drop plan, but it's at 0% interest. And then they give you a annuity every month. You can't even draw it out. So if you had $100,000 in the drop and you retired, you say, "Hey, I want my $100,000." They said, "No, you get a monthly annuity based off the life expectancy of 83." So I'm like, at 56, I'm going to hit my 90. I'm not going to put money into a 0% interest. And then you tell me I can only draw out $200 a month until I'm 83 years of age. Like it makes no sense anymore for people, in my opinion, to get into the drop. So when I hit 56, but Mike Jones, he was still putting into that drop plan, but he didn't stay for the money. He was losing money. He did it just for the passion and joy of coming to work.
That's something. 83 years old.
Yes, sir. And
That's that.
I'm not talking about laying on your ass, not doing anything. I'm talking about the dude was still full of piss and vinegar at 83.
That's awesome. Okay. With that being said, when you got to the rank of company officer, and now that you are Deputy Chief of Special Ops, what does leadership look like to you? What kind of leader did you want to be?
Yeah, so I've read, I think leadership is maybe the most written about subject in the world, right? There, you can. I've read them. I've read a ton of leadership books to try to figure that piece out. And I don't know that you can pick a style. I think you are a style, right? Like, I don't think you can read a book and say, "I'm going to be like this way." Like, you're somewhat. You take pieces that you grow with over time. Mike Jones had a different leadership style than my father, right? Like, and you pick up pieces, and I have some Mike Jones in me. He was an aggressive person, and no doubt a leader, no doubt not worried about your feelings. But he was so quick to forget. Like, if you got your ass eat out by Mike Jones, if you held that, that's on you because the next shift, he forgot it, right? And so I do think some of my leadership styles have come from things that I've picked up from people that I worked with. A lot of it, though, I think is just how you are as a person. I don't know that you can change from reading a book and go, "I'm going to be a servant leader or an autocratic leader." Like, I don't think you can do that. I think because you have a personality. I do think. I think we talk so much about leadership, but we don't talk enough about followership. Like, if I'm a leader, who am I leading? And so, in an organization, if your followers, the way it, if you have a vision for them, and you see things a certain way, and you have an expectation that they understand and that they can buy into, then the jobs are going to get done. And I largely, and sometimes it's doesn't always work, but building that relationship and having people want to do things for you because whether they respect you or they even just like you, instead of being, "Oh God, he's going to chew my ass if I don't take care of it." So fo your followers and finding those people that you've built relationships with over the years that bought into your mindset and your culture, because I can promise you, if I have a bunch of slugs working for me, my leadership style doesn't really work. because they don't buy into me. They don't have the same vision that I have. They don't have the same expectations or accountability that I have. And you're just never, you're never, you can lead by fear, and you can start that micromanagement. I say, hey, if you think you're being micromanaged, it's probably because you're not doing your job. So I don't like leadership style. I say basically, and I think this is how, when Courtney made me a deputy, there was a question about what is your greatest strength and what is your greatest weakness. And that was on my interview as on the panel that they asked me. And I said, it's the same. My strength and my weakness are the same. And I get a funny look from the fire chief. And I said, let me explain. When I'm not a very bright guy, okay? Like, I graduated with 21 people in my graduating high school class. I was number 12. I think I made a 730 on my SAT. I think you get a 700 for just putting your name on the test. Struggled through college, not a bright guy. So I go to college, and the professor's talking, and everybody's taking notes, and I can't spell. I'm pretty sure I'm dyslexic, never diagnosed, but I'm like, how are they sitting here taking notes? And I said, how am I going to be successful? How am I going to make it through college? I can't even sit here and take notes. And so I canvassed the room. And if I knew somebody that I could, hey, they're taking great notes. Hey, I'm going to build a relationship with them, become friends with them, talk to them. Hey, can I get a copy of those notes? We'll run and make copies. And I realized that the only way I was going to be successful was to build relationships with people. And I said, so that is my greatest weakness, is I'm not very smart and I can't do anything on my own. I cannot do, if you ask me to build spreadsheets or write this paper or come up with this policy or come up with a program, man, I'm not, I physically am not an elitist. I can't just pound that out on my own. But I've built relationships with people, and I know your strength and I know your weakness. And if you know your people that you're leading, if you say, if you build that relationship, and you say, you just talk to them and you start finding out what are they good at and what are they not good at. And we don't pick on the weakness. There was a time that, because I've taught officer development before, there was a time to say, hey, you know what you're not good at? You need to work on that. I've shifted from that 180 degrees. There's a reason you're not good at it. And if you're not good at it, I'm not going to make you be able to be good at it. But if I know what you're strong at, and I give you those jobs that I know that are in your wheelhouse, that you're comfortable in doing, that you find passion and joy in, and I give you that piece of this puzzle that I need to figure out whether it's a project, a policy, and I dole those out because we have a relationship. I say, hey, I know you're really strong in this area. Can you help me? People will love to help you. They want to do what they're passionate about and what they're good at. And I find the people. And so my weakness was, chief, if you want me to be a deputy chief, you want me to be in charge because you think I'm good at something, I'm not good at anything other than building relationships. And building those relationships with people that work for you and around you, and knowing what they're good at and what they're not, and then giving them the autonomy to do what they need to do. I don't know that that's a style of leadership, but that's what I do.
And I'd like to know more about your reasoning on, like, let's just say for me, if you were my officer and I struggled with, let's just say, throwing ladders, right? And you've tried everything under the sun, it's just not working. Most people think, well, in order to get better, you just need to continue to fail, continue to fail until you get it. But for you, it's like, well, then I'll find something else that you're better at.
Yeah, so here's the thing. First, I'm going to evaluate because I simplify everything. Things seem simple to, I say, hey man, let's keep it simple. Things don't have to be difficult. Do you, your inability to throw ladders, is that a lack of willingness or a lack of ability? Right? Like if it's a lack of willingness to do it, and if we're talking about task level on a fire engine. If you have a lack, why do you have a lack of willingness? You're like, well, for me, throwing ladders, that's a truck. I never rode a truck. I don't want to ride a truck. Like, so don't put me on the truck. I don't want to ride the truck. Truck is the throwing ladders. I never rode an engine. I don't know that I ever threw a ladder. That's not my job. So just say, hey, Cap, Lou, I don't have any desire to throw ladders. That's a lack of willingness, a lack of ability, either one. I'm talking about, I guess, the lack of willingness and the lack of ability I use in performance evaluations or training. Like, if it's a mandated thing, you don't want to do it. Well, there's certain things you have to do. If it's a lack of ability, then we train. Like, hey, man, you just don't do it. You're not doing it well. What do you do well? Well, if you don't throw ladders well, maybe you don't like, I'm not, I don't, we vertically ventilate in Dallas. I don't care two shits about getting on the roof and cutting a hole for ventilation. I don't want to be up there. I don't, that's not exciting. I did it one time. I'm like, this, like, I want to go take the knot. Like, what are you good at? What do you want to do? And let's focus on that. There's value. Like, a guy, just because they throw ladders well, I bet there's something they don't do well. Like, we don't have to be well at everything. We just got to find what you're good at and what you're passionate about and use you in those. Like, if we're at a fire and I know you're not good at it, I'm not going to say, Danny, throw the damn ladder. I got a ladder guy, I hope. Or I'm going to find a ladder guy, right? I need a nozzle man. I need somebody. It's like everybody wants to be on the nozzle. We are terrible in Dallas about having that three man pull hose. Nobody wants to be back there and pull hose. There's an art to pulling hose. I need a good hose puller at the door to run up and down the hose, work the kinks out. There's a place for you in my world.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. Okay. With that being said, I remember earlier before we started this conversation, you mentioned to me how you envy smaller departments when it comes to change because Dallas is such a large organization. And so to get things changed, it's not an overnight process.
No, absolutely not. And so I guess that was, so when I made deputy chief, I was Ada, what's funny enough, the deputy chief 806 on the north side, is at station 37 where I started my career. I spent 6.5 years there as a deputy chief of Division One of north of the river. I could talk about the river, north of the river. I was the deputy chief of operations on the north side on the B shift for 6.5 years. And so there was things that I can do within my division, but if I can't get the buy-in of the other five division chiefs running their divisions, and then the assistant chief, and then 59 fire stations, that there's all these subcultures, like, we're not going to do that. Well, and we'll get into a piece maybe about the difference between managing and supervising. Like, how much force, how much power do I have to turn this ship? If I wanted to build, I think we're terrible at, we don't have a strong search culture, which I didn't even know was a thing until I was a deputy chief in 806. And a lieutenant started talking about, and you have a deal about outside training. He was going to this outside training. He started talking about all this search, going to these search classes, this outside training. Like, in Dallas Fire, the whole thing was go put the fire out and then we'll walk around and see if anybody was in here. And we never had a strong search culture. And I got this lieutenant going to these outside classes and I was so intrigued. I'm like, how did we've used every excuse in the book of to stay aggressive is to search for people and victims, and we've never given it the priority that we say it was due. Like, we never taught our members the proper way to do it. And I got a few of these lieutenants that are going to these outside classes. Man, I found I call them an acquired structure, a structure that was going to be torn down. I talked to the owners, like, hey, before you tear this house down, can we train in it? Absolutely. Smoke it up. I let these lieutenants go to work. Like, hey, you're teaching my entire division search techniques, rescue techniques. Hey, you located, how do we get the victim out the window, right? And I trained all 30 of my fire stations on search. I didn't train them. I had these lieutenants that attended these outside classes, and I'm like, this stuff is amazing. Why have we never done this in my fire department? But I couldn't do it for the whole department. I couldn't. I'm not in charge of the other divisions, and nobody's like, nobody else is seeing my vision of changing the department to be a search culture department and not just put the fire out culture. That ship never got changed, right? For the department. I can create change, and you can only control the controllables. I controlled one division. I could not turn the whole ship around. It wasn't a vision for the assistant chief of operations. It was not a vision they had. And then, hey, poor job on me, right? I got a boss. I didn't do the due diligence I needed to do to explain to my boss the importance of search culture for my boss to say, yes, we're going to do this citywide. So there's failure on my part on that, but to turn a ship around of that many people, 2,000 people, and get 2,000 people to buy into a vision of we're going to change the mindset of this department is, I find, almost, unless it comes from the top, unless it comes from the, and people lump us all in. Hey, you're the deputy chief. You can, man, I have a boss. And I guess that's probably one of my failures, is not being able to share my vision of what we needed to do with search and get it bought across the fire department. So, but then like things like this. So, I have a friend, he teaches ladders, funny enough, in the colony, Garrett Rice. He goes across the country, teaches throwing ladders, right? And he works for the colony fire department, small fire department. And he's telling us about, hey, when they hire a brand new rookie, the deal is the senior firefighter calls the rookie and says, hey, I'm going to meet you in the parking lot at this time. I'm going to walk you in your very first shift of your career. We're going to walk in together. The most senior firefighter is in the parking lot. He doesn't go in the fire station. Rookie shows up for his first day at the fire department. The senior man shakes his hand and they walk in together. I'm like, how cool is that? In Dallas, we've been hiring, we're slowing down now, but we were hiring 50 members every 4 months. You'd be a battalion chief and a transfer list came out yesterday and you show up to work today and you got four rookies that are starting their first day. You didn't even know you were getting them. Like you come into an email or a station calls and says, hey chief, did you know, we got a rookie standing here. Did you know anything about it? I didn't know anything about it. Like they're pushing them out, giving them an assignment, putting that list out in an email saying, hey, these 50 guys are coming out. Here's where they're going. And as a battalion chief, you may not even know until the morning you get to work that you were getting three or four new rookies in your battalion. Like, not a really warm welcome for a brand new firefighter, right? But to create a culture of, hey, all 59 fire stations and all three shifts, your senior man's going to go out in the park. Like, we don't, it's not doable. I can't enforce that. I can't, like, if that station officer, number one, our station officer doesn't even know that they're getting a brand new rookie. And then to say the senior man is going to walk out, be in the parking lot. I just thought there's things you can do in a smaller department because if you have that shared vision, you have the right people. It's, I can, I need to create more buy, let, I can, the buy-in is easier if I have a vision, I explain the why. And that's another thing about, there's a video out there. We do the what, the how and the why, we do it backwards. Like I have to explain the why we're doing something to try to get you to understand. I can't just say, this is what we're doing and this is how we're doing it. But you didn't tell me why we're doing it. Why are we making this change? If I provide the why to you. And when the cancer deal came out, we had a, he's a battalion chief now. I think he was a captain at the time. He produced this cancer video about cleaning your gear. And we've had a lot of members die of cancer in my fire department. And that video highlights these members that have passed and members that had cancer and lived through it. And it provided such a why. Like in my years of firefighting, let's just say dumpster fires. You know how many dumpster fires I put my head in? Never put an SCBA on my back. Wasn't a culture in my fire department to put on an SCBA just to put out a dumpster. You pull the red line, you roll the door back, you stick your head in the dumpster, and there is no telling what the hell you were breathing. And never thought twice about it. Not one time in those years did I say, you know, this shit's probably really bad. I probably should put my SCBA on. But if I put my, I didn't even think it, but even if I had thought it, I wouldn't have done it because of the peer pressure. But when this officer that we had put together this video, after I watched the video, I mean, it was like, that's why we should be wearing our SCBAs on car fires. That's why we should be wearing our SCBAs on dumpsters. Like it provided the why. If we just said, if we just came out with a policy and said, you're going to wear your SCBA on dumpsters and car fires, but I didn't explain the why to you. I didn't give you the history. I didn't, hey, are you aware we've had 14 members die of cancer, or we had 30 members with cancer on this fire department. And we believe one of those reasons is your gear and not wearing your SCBA. Like there's the why. Now, if you don't do it now, I have no problem chewing your ass going, what the hell are you doing? Why do you not like, do you know everything I know? We let you know what is going on in this fire department with cancer. And so providing the why is such a huge in change. So we go back to your original small departments. If I can provide 100 guys the why and give you the vision, then I think you get a change quicker than 2,000. It's just so hard.
Yeah. No, okay. Respect that. since I have you on here and you are a part of a large organization, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna know what you're gonna say, but I'm gonna ask you this question because there are other firefighters I have talked to they're not gonna take my word for it because I don't work for a large organization, but are there the same problems in Dallas as in a department that has only like six stations, eight
Absolutely.
stations, when it comes to the bullshit and whatever else?
Absolutely. Fire, it is, and I do get it. I just went to the Fire Rescue International Conference last week, and I do think, I'm not saying it's an intimidation, but when you say Dallas, large metro department, I think people think that we think, or that I think, and maybe I'm not saying there's not people in my department that don't, but I don't. Like, oh, we're Dallas. We're a large department. You don't understand. You're not us. You don't do what we do. Bullshit. Firemen are firemen. If you're a fireman, you're a fireman. It doesn't matter what department you work for. Like, the mentality is the same. The shit talking is the same. We got aggressive station over here. We got a lazy guys over here. We got guys that want to do it over here. We have the same exact problems you have, just on a larger scale of city, whether it's 60 fire stations, 30 fire stations, 10 fire stations. I believe that we all have the same issues.
For sure. Okay. So I just wanted that clarification because,
Yeah.
it's funny because when I worked for when I used to work at a part-time department, a lot of those members worked for a very large organization in the state. And a lot of them would tell you, like, I'd tell them some things going on, and they'd be like, bro, we got the same issues. I'm like, for real? And they're like, yeah, man, we got slugs, we got good guys. We got guys that want to train, we got guys that don't. The only difference is at their organization, some of those individuals can go hide.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The same thing. We got stations that are running, pumping 20 runs a shift. We got stations that, fires have slowed down. I think fires slowed down everywhere. I think we have less fires today than we had in 2000. Obviously, we have way less fires in my dad's years of the 70s and 80s, early 90s. But there's places that you can go. There's stations in Dallas you can go make 2 to 5 runs a shift, never have a fire, go a year without having a fire. Like, there's places to go if you're here to draw. I call you either Facebook fireman or t-shirt fireman. Like, the only way we're going to know whether you're a fireman or not is when we go to a fire, and the fire has a it is going to tell us whether you are a firefighter or you just wear the t-shirt. Are you just here for the So you get to tell people whether you like the schedule of the that you're on, whether it's 24, 48, 48, 96. Like, you like the schedule, you like the benefits, you like to tell people you're a firefighter. You wear it, walk around with your t-shirt. Hey, I walk around my t-shirt all the time. Proud to be a Dallas firefighter. I wear a Dallas Fire Department t-shirt all the time. Proud of my organization, proud who I work for. There's slugs out there that wear the same t-shirt, and people thank you for your service and all that bullshit. That those guys are slugs and you don't even know it. They wouldn't be able to save your ass. They wouldn't save your life. They have no desire. And the fire tells us that. Like, when we go to a job and have a fire, firemen are going to be firemen, and the other ones are going to have can't find a glove, can't get their SCBA turned on, have mass problems, slow roll, screw, can't get the line stretched to the front door. Like, if we wait long enough, we will have to go defensive. If we walk around, hey, I understand 360s, and hey, we can walk around and we can fiddle fuck around long enough that there's so much fire that we can all stand out in the yard, put a ladder pipe on it, squirt water from 20 feet away. Hell, my 19-year-old daughter can do that shit. Like, that's not being a firefighter. Like, and we don't know that. And people can talk a good game, right? Some don't have any interest in talking the game or the lingo. Others can talk the lingo, and then, like, hey man, he sounded like he was a real deal. We go to a fire, he's a zero. And that's why I said the greatest compliment you can get in the Dallas Fire Department is he's a damn good firefighter. Like, okay. You tell me that. I got you. I know what you're talking about.
Okay. I want to ask you two chief officers questions because I don't get very many chief officers on here, but when I do, I always like to ask. First question. As a leader of the organization, whether it's battalion chief or above, why do you think chiefs let crews or individuals that are mediocre stay exactly just that?
Yeah, that's for me, it's kind of an easy question. We'll start off with what is mediocre and mediocre at what? Like, so as a chief, we have annual evaluations. I do an evaluation every year on you. Nowhere on there does it say he is mediocre or below. There's not a box for me to check there, right? And so when we talk about mediocre, what are they mediocre at what? They're not very good at what? Are we talking about just fighting fires? Because when the bell hits, we go on the runs. We all know, hey, 80%, 90% of these runs are going to be medical. They do the bare minimum. Like, you're a civil service employee in the city of Dallas. We have never fired anybody that I know of for being a slug. Like, we fire people for drug offenses, we fire people for felony offenses. We've never fired anybody because you're not very good at this job. And so, if we can only evaluate your abilities of being good at the job at a fire, how many fires did you have this year? Right? How many times did I get to see that? And then, hey, was that just a one-off? So if you're only going to three fires a year and you stumped your toe at one, okay. Like, hey, there's not a clear definition of I mean, I can run. It's basically I can browbeat you. I can force you to train. I can't force you to care. I can't fight. Like, what was the and I don't. I'm not in charge of. I'm in charge of special ops SOPs, right? What was the policy violation? We don't have a policy violation on mediocrity, being subpar. Hey, if the member is like. Hey, so is it a lack of willingness or is it lack of ability? You know how much paperwork and how much time a chief would have to spend on one member to build up enough paperwork and be knowledgeable about the rules and write up, here's a letter of counseling for this, and then stay on top of that or to create a performance improvement plan. And we've started doing those a little bit. So some of it is, well, in our department, we've never fired somebody for not being very good at the job or not caring to be good at the job, being lazy. If you do, you're going to spend the majority of your time writing, documenting, keeping track, reinforcing, counseling, coaching. You're going to have to keep track of everything you've done with the members. So some of it is laziness on a chief's part. Like, but I can tell you at a deputy level, you're going to have to rely heavily on your battalion chiefs because I have in my division, I have 280 people. Well, if I have 280 people, how often do I get to lay hands or visually see that person not doing their job? I rarely see it. So then how often does the battalion chief get to see it? Like, a crew, one station may know the other station and say, man, that guy's a slug. Okay. Well, here's the difference between when you talk, because you asked a chief's question. I didn't know the difference between managing and supervising. And I read management books and I've read supervisory books through the ranks and studying for promotion. It didn't really make sense to me until I became a battalion chief. The difference between supervising and managing. So a station officer supervises. So I don't know if y'all do this. We had to go paint hydrants and flow plugs, or whether it's pre-fire plans. Whether it's training evolutions, that station officer is performing with their crew. They are supervising, but they are part of it. You don't, as a station officer, say, hey, y'all go paint hydrants today. Y'all go do TISs today. I'm going to sit here at the fire station. No, you physically go and you create the what, like that station's going to run the way that officer runs, right? As a battalion chief, you manage. So, we have a deal, you're supposed to do 25% of your hydrants every quarter. So, hey, you're keeping track if you're a good battalion chief. The quarter's coming up. Maybe the deputy chief says, here's the list. You have two stations that haven't done any hydrants this quarter. Like, you need to be at 25%. Well, I manage the hydrant. I don't physically, as a battalion chief, go paint all the hydrants with my stations. I go to the station officer and say, "Hey, you need to go get your hydrants done. You need to be at 25% by next shift." I manage that. And so until I know as an officer, you say, as a battalion chief, you'd have to let me know, "Hey, I got a problem over here." Okay. Well, I can tell you, I've managed a lot of problems. I've helped my battalion chiefs through that. I've had meetings with the members. But it takes a lot of paperwork, a lot of documentation, a lot of meetings, and stay on top of it, on top of it. But when we're talking about, are they mediocre at what? Like, because they're not aggressive firemen, because they slow roll, because they're not quick, because they like it just, unless we have a policy or procedure that we can fall back on and point, and we're willing to do a lot of work and invest a lot of time. When I was a battalion chief, my deputy chief said, "You will spend 90% of your time dealing with 10% of your people that are the problem. Do you want to spend 90% of your time?" And maybe you should. My deal was, I want to spend 90% of my time with 90% of my people. Like, how much am I willing to invest? And have we ever, is all this work that I'm going to put in, man, maybe you get to a point where you get them, they're a little better for a while. They get out of the heat, right? Okay, man, they were feeling the heat. They were feeling the pressure from the chief. My deputy chief, when I was battalion chief, he would always say, "I got my stinger out for that guy." And it wasn't until I became a deputy chief, I knew what he was talking about. "Hey, man, if that dude messed, I'm waiting on that guy to give me an opportunity to write him up. Like, he's a slug. Like, I got to find the right policy. He's got to do the right thing. Like, but I know who they were." But how much time and energy and documentation, and then in the end, what's the result going to be? And we go down to, we would have to have a chain of command hearing. The fire chief had to present all the information that we have, and then the fire chief determines time off, short suspension, long suspension, those things. Like, it is labor intensive. And I don't think as a chief level, you see that member enough to see daily is the member getting better. So we wanted to push everything back down. There's no greater position than the station officer and getting that station officer. And what happens in Dallas most of the time is we say, "Transfer your problem," right? Like, "Cap, you're gonna go do training evolutions. You see this member every day. You got to document every day what the member is doing. Are they improving? I'm not living with that member 24 hours. You're living with that member 24 hours. I'm over here running a battalion. I got And we dump a lot of things. Everything rolls to the battalion chief to manage at those battalions. So they have a lot to manage. They can't just focus on one problem child. But so we push things to the station officer, and I don't have any problems helping support the station officer and tell the station officer, "Here's everything I want you to do with the member." But as a chief officer, I'm not with that member every day. I'm not seeing that member every day and saying, "Hey, man, are they getting better? Are they not getting better?" Like, if you want to do a performance improvement cap, we'll go through those steps. I'll work those steps with you. But it is going to require a ton of documentation and work on your end. And most officers don't want to do it and say, "You know what? I can put enough pressure on this member, they'll write a letter to leave." Because in our department, there's 59 fire stations and three shifts. If you're not happy here, go somewhere else. So,
Okay. The second question is that slug, okay, who just or where we won't even use the word slug. We'll use that nice
yes,
guy,
the nice
right?
guy, right?
The nice guy, he's been a nice guy most of his career, and that nice guy decides to promote and then gets promoted. Do you see an issue wrong with that in today's fire service? I mean, I'm sure there's nothing people can't do, but like I'll hear or I'll talk to other chiefs that'll be like, they do a program where in order for that person to get promoted, they do like a peer review. Who knows better than that person than the people that they have to work with? You know what I mean? But we all know individuals who like the promotion list comes out and that nice guy got promoted, like, do they think he or she's really going to do any change? What's your take on that?
When I'm listening to you talk, I have visual images of people in my department. I can see the faces of the people that you're talking about.
Okay.
And our department chooses to not do anything. Now, me personally, so like I brought up performance evaluations. And this goes back to, yes, this is a huge problem that unless the fire chief wants to address this and clean it up, there's ways to go about it, right? You brought up maybe a department that does it away. And absolutely. So our performance evaluations are meaningless. So they used to be years and years ago, you had to have three meets, or you had, I'm sorry, you had to have three exceeds to get your merit raise. So a firefighter, one, two, it's years, right? Like you top out after 5 or 6 years to be a topped out FRO in pay. And then same thing, driver, your first year driver, you make a little more money. In the second year, you make a little more, and then you top, it's called topping out at a rank, right? Well, used to your performance evaluations, you had to have three exceptional checks to get your merit. So you wouldn't get your pay increase if you didn't get three exceptions. They did away with it. Like our performance evaluations are meaningless. On top of being meaningless, we've never trained an officer how to fill out a performance evaluation, and we don't do true evaluations. I'll tell you how most of our evaluations go. Hey man, come in here and sign this eval. You're doing a great job. No problem. Just sign here. You can read it if you want to. We don't, the officers, like, they must do it. It's not something they want to do. They wait till the last minute. They don't truly sit down and evaluate their people. And so that's a cultural problem. How we should do it would be like, just like you're saying, hey, these evaluations mean something. Maybe they're, do you have to have a point system in order to, maybe it gives you points on the exam. There's definitely ways to address that, but then it goes back to, and we have three associations in Dallas. So we have the local association, Local 58 Union. We have the Black Firefighters Association. We had the Hispanic Firefighters Association. How do we know? And here I'm going to show the other side of that coin. How do we know that, regardless, pick a race and pick a different race that's that person's supervisor, and you just don't like me because of my color? If you're telling me you don't have any racism in your fire department, congratulations. I probably get ridiculed for this. Do I believe that there's racism in our still in the fire service? I do. So that's how some of those things get killed on ideas on, hey, how do we know that that officer is being fair on grading that member, that this is not a personal dislike for a certain race or person or gender even, right? Like, so it's then the associations will get involved, right, wrong, or different, and say that's not fair. Like, we don't know that. So there's always obstacles to creating some way to prevent those nice guys from promoting. But I can tell you the majority of them that weren't worth the shit as a driver still weren't worth the crap as a lieutenant. And now I got one in mind that's a battalion chief. And I go, man, I just don't see, I don't know. One, I can't believe the person took the interest in studying, because they never showed any interest in any rank they ever held below that. But it's hard to come up with a fair system to prevent it. I'll just say that the fire chief would approve, that the associations would approve. I personally think when you talk about promotions, I think it should be an interview panel of chiefs in your own department. So every rank but driver, lieutenant, captain, battalion chief, all have a written exam and then an assessment center. And we bring out outside assessors. I think the assessors should be the members within our department that know these members. Right? Like, and that can be a diverse group of chiefs. We can make sure we have a proper demographic of this fire department. and grade those members through an interview process, through an assessment center process, and that to me would be the fairest way to go about it. A fully based chief level panel of an assessment that crosses all demographics and genders. And bam, I just solved it, right? Let's do it. Because, I hate these. But then I'll go this way. There's never been a rank that when I made captain, I looked back and said, I wasn't a very good lieutenant. Hey, you know what? When I made lieutenant, I wasn't a very good driver. And people may say, there may be people say he ain't worth a dang it being a deputy chief, but I have a fair assessment of myself. I think that until I make a higher rank, I go, I could have been such a better captain because now I know what I need from my captains. As a battalion chief, I know what I expect from my captains, and shit, I'm expecting that, and I wasn't that. Now I say, hey, I will say this. I never had an officer that I worked under that told me I didn't meet their expectations. But then I also had people that didn't give me any expectations when I make a rank. When you should be able to go to your supervisor, your new supervisor, when you promote and say, what is your expectations? What are your non-negotiables? Because I want to make sure I don't cross those lines. And we do such a bad job at that. We do a bad job at a lot of things, to be honest. But to sit down and say, here's my expectations of you. These are my non-negotiables. Do not cross this line. This is how I want you to, we're going to follow these things and do it this way. If we don't do that to our subordinates, what do we expect to get if they don't know what to expect? I don't know if that answered your question. I can ramble
No,
for.
it definitely did. And that last part that you stated to me, that it's powerful. Like, if you want your department to succeed, you have to set expectations. Now, here's a question that goes along with that. For you being a deputy chief, hell, even when you were a battalion chief, you knew taking that rank, taking that responsibility, that there are going to be times you're going to have hard conversations, correct?
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
So my question is that, well, it's not really a question. Well, actually, it is a question. Why is it that we have certain individuals in positions that when you ask a hard question, they either don't want to give you the answer or they give you the runaround? And to me, it's if you're going to hold a title of whatever the case may be, you're gonna have to have hard conversations with people. You can't say, all right, I want to be chief of whatever organization, and then have an issue or that person ask you a difficult question. You have to be able to have those conversations. You can't just push them to the side or give them the runaround and maybe be like, well, they'll forget about it and it'll go away.
Having difficult conversations, there's an art to it. And so I have a tendency to try to go around everything and make it come back to a point. You had a question in there about should you have so much time on before you can make
Yes.
another a rank,
Right.
right? And we kind of do, but it's so loose that by the time they give an exam, if it's you're a lieutenant and that list runs 18 months and you got to be a lieutenant 2 years before you can test for captain, well, that's gonna happen. But I know guys, like I was young, right? I made driver with 6 years on, and I'm testing. I never stopped studying. I'm studying for lieutenant, and people like, hey, there would be always be conversations. You don't have the experience. Young guys don't have any business. You should do your time. You shouldn't promote. You're too young. And not just me, in general, young people studying for promotional exams. And in my department, it was like, okay, well, I'm missing half of the fires because I'm on the ambulance. So you want me to work how long? Who gets to say when there's enough experience to move up the ranks? Because I'll say this, it doesn't matter. You're going to make mistakes. Like once you get promoted at a rank, when you get moved to the front of that engine and you're making those decisions, you're going to make mistakes. And it's what you do with those mistakes. I'll say I never fought a perfect fire. Like I never went to bed after a fire and said, man, I knocked it out of the park. As a battalion chief, did I command that? Like, man, I never laid in bed and said, I kicked ass. I lay in bed and I am my biggest critic. People are not ready for tough conversations, probably because they haven't had them before. It's uncomfortable. It creates confrontation. People don't want, like, people shy away from confrontation. I don't want to hurt your feelings. I don't want you to be mad at me. I want you to like me. Leadership's not about being liked, but people want to be liked. And I want you to like me. And to have a tough conversation means you're probably not going to like me. You're going to not like my answer. If I know you're not going to like my answer, I'm going to sugarcoat it. And so until you're thrust into those positions and you make mistakes in tough conversations and you go, you know what? I've had enough of these. Why do I handle them so bad? Why am I shying away from the confrontation? Why do I get uneasy and nervous? And why do I want to be liked so much? This guy's going to trash me if I have a tough conversation. I want him to go out and say, Chief Kroger's the coolest guy, man. He's so easy. Like being in charge is not easy. Being an officer is not easy, but you want people to like you and you want them not to be mad and you don't want to have that uncomfortable conversation. And then it becomes a growth period where you say, you know what? No, I love this fire department. I'm true in my values. I know where I'm coming from. I know where I stand. I know what I see. And I have a setup. I call it the bridge, Danny. And I ask a lot of questions, even in a tough conversation. I got to know where your head is. Like how far apart are we on this issue and where are you coming from? So I don't just come at you. I don't just attack, confrontation, tough conversation. Let me tell you, that's not me. I'm going to ask a lot of questions and I'm trying to gauge how long is the bridge? Like how far apart are we on this issue? I use this example because I was real big in we created a sim lab, and as a deputy chief, I would take captains that were going to, before they could ride up as a battalion chief, when the battalion chief was off, I would watch them simulate being in command of a fire. And I have a guy that just is doing a terrible job. He is effing this thing up. It's terrible. And the people running the sim lab like, Chief, I can't wait to see how you handle this because we're fixing to have a tough conversation. He sucks. So you gauge. You're like, I don't come in and say, hey man, you suck. This is gonna like I don't attack you. I say, hey Danny, how do you think you did on that sim? And if you go, man, I struggled. Okay, man, this is fixing to be a shorter bridge than I anticipated. You didn't do very strong at that. You weren't very good at that. This is going to be a short bridge and an easier conversation. This particular member at one time says, I knocked it out of the park. Okay, Danny, long bridge. This is fixing to be a long bridge conversation because you were terrible. You think you knocked it out of the park. So now I'm going to say, why do you think you knocked it out of the park? I'm not just going to immediately say, jump into this. I'm gathering facts, trying to get where your head is to try to get your understanding of this situation. And sometimes it gets it. Hey, okay. He keeps telling me why he was an all-star. And now here comes, hey, you didn't. You didn't. You didn't knock it out of the park. I've took notes. Let's go over my notes. This is everything I took. You said you would do this. That's not what we that that's going to cause this to be a problem. You're not seeing it. And I'm going to try to educate you, but now I'm still gauging. Are you going, oh, I see. Oh, I understand. Are you still defiant? Like, are you? And so I'm just going to keep, hey, and at the end of the day, when this tough conversation in the end, Danny, I'm in charge. And I'm telling you, you did a poor job. And I'm telling you, we're going to keep working at it, but you're not riding that chief's car. I don't believe you're ready. And your readiness is based off of what I think. So you can either get on board with me and start thinking my way, or you'll never ride that damn car. And so even with personnel problems, I had a member come in. I had a complaint from a citizen. I'm gauging, like, this is going to be a tough conversation. This member really did some things that were inappropriate in how they handled the situation. But I don't just go on the attack in this tough conversation. But all of that came with time and experience of doing it wrong and going, you're doing it wrong. Like, you're not leading, you're not in charge, you're sugarcoating, you're scared, you want to be liked so bad, you don't want to piss the member off, you want to just, and that happens at the fire station too. Everybody's got to get along with Cap or Lou. And so if Lou's running around saying, this fire department sucks, this place is a shithole, you're talking about a tough conversation. There's not a member in that fire station. If you go, Cap, you're wrong. Like, we're fixing to have a tough conversation. I think this is a great department. I think we're doing a lot of good things. You're going to be ridiculed. All those guys are going to fall in line with that officer and their beliefs. They're going to go around saying, the fire department sucks. The chief is a dumbass. Why do we do this stupid stuff? All because Cap's doing that. Nobody's going to stand up to Cap, right? And so the same thing, battalion chiefs want to be like, they want their captains to get along. They want them to like them. They don't want to stand up and have, hey, man, you're wrong. Let me tell you, like, so it's about how you learn to approach those conversations, those tough conversations. And I actually got to where, I used to dread them. Like, oh gosh, man, this guy's going to come over here and he's going to be pissed. And this is a problem. And then I was like, no, man, I'm always going to be fair. You're not always going to like what I have to say. I'm going to gauge how well you're receiving the information. At end of the day, I'm the judge and the jury on this deal. And like, I'm going to try to get you to buy in. I'm going to try to get you to understand the point of view. And then there's the other side of that, the tough conversation. If I only have one side of the information, if I just go off of this and I don't hear you out on what your issues are and why, like what you want to talk about in this tough conversation, go, Danny, I didn't know that. Tell me more about that, because I didn't get that side of the story. Because there's always two sides of the story. And if I try to make a decision based off of just one side of the story, then I'm wrong. And so, so many times I'm like, you'll get a call from downtown saying this is an issue you need to handle, and go, man, that sounds really bad. Oh my gosh, I can't believe this guy would do that. And you call the member in and go, man, that guy's got a whole different story. Like, there's always like, there's two sides of the story, and somewhere in the middle is the truth a lot of times. Like, so it's an art. I think it's an art. I think it takes time, but you at some point, whatever I do, I will lay in bed, or I'll sit here at my desk and I'll think, I'll rewind that situation and go, how did I handle it? When I was a captain, and I had an issue with a member, I didn't have a lieutenant. I had a paramedic driver who I thought the world of this guy. And I knew that member would not be a driver he was going to promote. So I would bring the member in into these tough conversations. One, to see how I handled the tough conversation as a captain. This is not going to be pleasant. But you're going to be an officer one day, and I want you to be exposed to this tough conversation. I don't want you to say anything. You're just, whether you're, I call you my witness, I call this just, hey man, this is, I want you to sit back and I want you to watch this. But then when the member would leave, I say, hey, his name was John. I say, hey, John, how did you think that went? How did you think I did how this conversation, give me your insight into what. I'm engaged. My heart, my blood pressure's up. I'm trying to control my heart rate. I'm sweating. It's a tough conversation, but I'm having it. I'm digging in. He's over there. He can relax. He's not a member. He's not engaged. He's just sitting back watching. And you got to have friends like that, and people that in your corner that will be honest with you. I don't want to hear, Cap, you knocked it out of the park, Cap. You gave it to him, man. You were right, Cap, man. Man, that's not what I'm at. That's if you gave me that bullshit, but that's not what I'm asking. I got to get better at this. How, like, honestly, what did I do well in that situation? And what do you think? I can't believe you said that. Why would you ask that? Like, I wouldn't have handled it that way. I need that feedback if I'm going to grow. And it's all about growth. And whether it's handling these personnel problems or tough conversations, fire ground is the same way. I tell young members all the time, man, I've been on 26 years. If you go to a fire and you didn't learn something new, you've missed something. Because even at 26 years, I can go to a fire and I can learn something. I don't know everything. This fire did something different. That building construction was something I hadn't seen before. And so when you talk about experience, because there's a question there about, hey, should experience matter? Having, man, my experience is not your experience. Like, if I go to a busy fire station and we're pumping 20 runs a shift and we have fires pretty regular, and you go to a station and y'all are making 5 runs a shift and you only had one or two fires that year, did we have the same 1 year experience?
That's right.
No, we didn't have the same experience. And then, but I can go, there's guys that have like 20 years on the fire department and they still do things just like they did 20 years ago. And they hadn't learned anything new and they think they know, hey man, I've had fires for 20 years. I mean, if you're not still learning, you're missing golden opportunities. And so I take even young guys when we go to fires, okay, we had a fire. How much can we get out? How much knowledge and experience can I provide you with that fire? Yeah, man, you did great. We got the line stretched, we got put on the fire, you knocked the. Did you see this? And let's relive that experience and draw every learning opportunity out of it, because there's only three ways to get good at this job: training, education, experience. That's it. Training, education, experience. So when we can handle training, we can do that. We can educate you, but I can't control the experience. And so if we're having fewer fires and we have a fire and that's our experience, can we draw every ounce of experience out of it? Instead of just saying, hey, you went and put the fire out, good job, let's put the hose up and let's go home. Like, if I don't dive into your experience from the front door through what you felt, what you saw, what you heard after the fire, looking back, retracing, did you know this room was off to the left? Did you feel this? Did you see this? And relive that. Hey, look at this building construction. Look how that fire ran through that void space up into the at like. I'm going to try to get every ounce of training education out of that experience. So it gives you a lot more than just, we went and put the fire out. I don't really know anything else. So that's it.
Love it. Love the answer. Beautifully stated. My last question for you. Where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
That's a really tough question for me, because my career took a way different path than I ever anticipated. And I'm not going to say being a deputy chief has provided me great opportunity. I think everybody should have to do staff. You talk about guys at the fire station and the things they talk about or whatever. You don't have any idea what it takes to run outside of the four walls of a fire station to actually run a fire department. And for me, running special operations, emails, meetings, decisions. Have a vision for what I would like to do with special ops, but it's not my passion. And I guess that's probably because you're asking my passion. I still romanticize about riding a fire engine. And so there is regret in the career path in the end. I do it. I get jealous of, I have several friends out of my rookie class. I'm by far nowhere close to the smartest guy in the rookie class, but I'm the highest rank of people in my class. And I have a lot of friends in rookie from my rookie school that stayed captains. And I'm so envious of that. Like, if you, what I would love to be on a fire engine and go to another fire. I would love to stretch a line and have fire, a lot of fire, and that I got to go find. And by the, like, I miss it. I miss it more than anything. So, like, I told you I read a lot of leadership books, and Extreme Ownership by Jocko. I made a decision to put in for deputy. I got made a deputy 8 years ago. I have a job to do for the Dallas Fire Department. I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. I'm going to focus my next 6 years until I retire on improving our Special Operations Division. But when you ask me, look, like what am I like, how that's going to look, it's not my passion. My passion was, and I miss it so much that it hurts. It hurts to think that the thing that you're passionate about, you're not going to get to do that. So I really don't want, I don't really want to think about hanging it up or what the next, when it's over with, looking back at my career, because by the time I think I figured out how to be good at it, I had already promoted out of it, I guess. Like, I think I would be a damn good engine captain. I would think I could be a damn good battalion chief. And those the, going to fires was my passion, and I promoted out of it. So if people are listening, you think promote, 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 promote. Yeah, man, I got more money for the rest of my life, but I worked myself into a position that is not my love. That for the majority, like when you think about how lucky you are to have a career, like there was never one day when I was a firefighter, an officer on a fire engine, or even a battalion chief, not one day did I go, oh, shit, man, I got to go to work. I got to go to work. I don't want to go to work. There was not a single day that it wasn't like, man, I get to go to the fire station. That is like, I get to go. Can you believe they pay us to go hang out and go to fires and just go on runs and like, I didn't like whatever the person needed. Hey, what a fantastic job that you're sitting here hanging out with your buddies, you're eating, and the bell hits, and instantaneously there's this flip of the switch. We go to the apparatus, we roll out the door, we're screaming down the road, lights and sirens, we roll up. What do you need? Whether it's a fire, car wreck, like we have a job to do, is to take care of the citizens. What do they need? Take care of that need. And you did it good. And you get back on the fire engine, you go back and hang out with your crew. Like they pay you to do that. Like I never even looked at a paycheck for all those years. I never worried about the money because I would never done anything else. And so when you like, what does your career look like here at the end? It looks like emails, meetings, budget decisions. What can we like? It truly is just management, and it's not a passion. I'm going to do it to the best of my abilities. I am. I'm driven that way. I got a good staff here that buy into what I want to do here in special operations, and it does provide some enjoyment, but it's a struggle because it's not my passion, and I'll just leave it at that.
And that's real. That's a real answer with real emotions. And I love that. I love that, Chief. With that being said, I want to thank you for coming on and just being truly authentic. And I'm not trying to say my other guests have not, but you don't hear very many chiefs high up in positions that talk the way you do. And to me, and I'm sure other firefighters, that's what we yearn more for. We want those chiefs to, like, for me, for example, I won't even talk about anybody else, but for me, if I fuck up, I want a chief to be like, hey man, you know you messed up. Like, this is gonna be a difficult conversation. You're not gonna like the outcome, whether it's suspension, whatever the case may be. But I'm at a point in my career where I can't get mad at you for something that I did. Like, I'm gonna take ownership that I fucked up. And I'll tell you, yep, 100% right. I did mess up. And for example, because I'd like to be 100% authentic and true and real, what, a week ago, I got a written verbal warning for excessive speed while operating an apparatus. And
Sure.
so I got called into the office. Well, first off, my lieutenant got called in the office, and I was like, okay. And then once he comes out, my battalion chief points at me and gives the little finger wave of come here. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm trying to think, what did I do?
Right.
And we sitting down, and my training chief is sitting there, and he's like, hey, I just let you know we got a complaint, such such blah blah blah. you were driving the apparatus to stay going this call, and we can't have this type of speed going on. And I'm like, okay. Like, I didn't immediately fire back, like, what the fuck? Like, all this other stuff. It was okay. What did I do? And they told me, I'm like, all right, I accept it. And I told my battalion chief with my training chief there, I'll correct it. Like, we're done. I'm not going to hold a grudge on my battalion chief or my training chief for me putting them in a situation where, hey, we're going to have to handle this. And it's like, okay, like we're not going to be perfect, whether that's driving, whether that's you pull a line, you botched a stretch, you threw the ladder miserably, it damaged something on the house, or it hell, it didn't even make it. We're all going to fuck up at some point. But for me, it's like, message clear, understood. I signed my paperwork, out the door I went. Did it hurt a little bit? Yeah, because I watched two distinctive people drive, and I'm like, I like they're aggressive, but they're
Sure.
safe aggressive. You know what I mean? And
Absolutely.
the ones that won't understand it are the ones who've never been around those individuals to be like, hey, this driver knows their shit. They know how to drive. They know how to pump. Like, that's what I want to emulate. But I get it. I took it a little too far, and I am 100% okay with it. I own it. What I can't stand though are the shit talkers that are like, "Did you hear? Did you hear?" Because I got a buddy of mine who's a really good buddy of mine, a true brother, who was like, "Hey, such and such mentioned your name and regarding your situation." He's like, "I didn't say shit." And I'm like, "All right, cool." But it's like, everybody has my number. You can call and ask, but instead you're gonna run your fucking mouth
Right.
behind, and instead of going to the source. Because I tell you, if you call me, yep, 100%. Hey, new and upcoming drivers, don't do what I did, because that's what I told my two firefighters after that. I said, hey, learn from me, don't do what I did. And that's the only way we grow. But I just can't stand those shit talkers who smile in your face, and then as soon as you leave, they're talking shit behind your back.
So several things on that, so I tell young firefighters all the time, hey, the only way you're not going to fuck up is if you don't do anything.
That's
That's the
right.
only way. That's the only way you can. If you do, you if you're not messing up, it's because you're not doing anything. Because you're going to mess up. And then talking about the tough conversation being called in, I always finish my conversation, tough conversation, in a disciplinary situation like you're talking about. I say, hey, man, you can be mad at me. You can go out this door and you can trash me. I'm going to put my arm around you tomorrow. I hold no grudge. I have a job to do. I'm going to do my job, and you may not like it, and that's okay. I want you to understand, I'm not going to shy away from shaking your hand next time. I'm not going to not make face, eye contact. I'm not going to not engage you. It's over. Like this, I think you're a great guy. I think you're doing good things. This is an issue. We got to clean this up. But I'm going to shake your hand after this, and you get to choose whether you begrudge me or not. I don't really care. I think of you the same as I did before this issue. I'll think of you the same after this issue. It's just an issue that we're going to handle. And I would finish it that way. The piece about the shit talkers is what we laughed about. I laugh about. We say that firefighters are alpha males. And so many of them are just gossip mill, whiny little bitches. Like, hey man, if you want to ask me something, my door's open. Like if you want to, I hold nothing back. I have a bad tendency to, if you ask me, I'm going to tell you. You ask me, I'm going to tell you what I think. Just come ask me though. Don't be over there two doors down talking shit, asking, trying to get. Hey, you come ask me. But we're not there. Those guys aren't alpha. They want to fucking know. Hey man, I heard this. Did this happen? Like, call the source. You don't have to fucking sneak around. And it's everywhere. That. It's just the gossip mill. These guys love it. Instead of like, hey man, you want to ask me about the situation? I'll tell you about the situation. Now, from your point, from a battalion chief's point or deputy chief's point, I share none of my closed door disciplinary issues with anybody. Like, but I'll laugh because I have done this before. I'd be in the kitchen as a deputy chief of the station I worked at. And whether it's on a higher back or my shift or whatever, I'll hear guys talking, and I'm be like, I'll just say, hey, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, and I'm just gonna leave it at that. But the shit you're talking right now, you don't know what you're wrong, and you don't know what the hell you're talking about, and I'm just gonna leave it at that. Like, I'm not going to let y'all keep doing that shit in front of me. When I'm sitting here, I know the situation. I have direct knowledge of a situation or chief level knowledge of it. And that these guys are down here just spreading rumor that's not true.
Facts.
Like, so anyway.
Yeah. No, love it, Chief. Like I said, I appreciate it. I've thoroughly enjoyed this interview. Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing me to talk to you beforehand. Us getting a game plan and you coming out here just telling the truth, like being real, being authentic. Some may not like it, some may disagree, but it's a lot of it was facts that was put on there. So I just want to say thank you, sir, for coming on.
Hey man, I appreciate you having me. I've never done one of these, but always willing to come on and visit.
Okay. All right. I'll put that in. I'll put that in the notes for sure.
All right. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
All right.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.